Welcome to the 24th episode of The Lucid Truth, Virtual Psychedelics, with Sarah Finn. For starters, this interview is not for the faint of heart. It takes a dive off the deep end into the nature of consciousness, the function of psychedelics, and the interplay between these ideas and the emerging field of virtual reality. What if you could show your friends what LSD is like by giving them your VR headset and letting them experience the fun for themselves? It seems the reality of such a prospect is closer than the fiction of it. And I hope this conversation makes you consider the horizons that are slowly coming into view. So now I bring you Sarah Finn. Thanks for joining us, Sarah.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Yeah, we're happy to have you. So you, what is your work? You try to program psychedelics into the virtual reality experience. What kind of got you interested in this field, and what really is it?
That's a good question. Lots of different people are approaching it from different angles since virtual reality is a new technology and art form. I personally have a background as a visionary artist, as a painter and a performance artist. Mm-hmm. And it's been in the past 2 years or so that I've personally dived in to virtual reality. Although I would say my interest started in about 2014. And initially I have an interest and developed my interest in virtual reality because it was a medium that my audience could be inside the art. It was a way to kind of convey a subjective experience. And as a performance artist, I used a lot of projection stuff to create an immersive environment that would transform the space that I was in as well as my audience, kind of take them on that journey with me. A lot of my art was inspired by visionary states and plant medicine, stuff like that. And so virtual reality just seemed like the next step in creating something that would really envelop the imagination of the viewer. And it was also cool because performance art is very intimate. It's very small audience a lot of the time in the underground. So virtual reality is a way to create an experience that's non-geographic. You know, I could collaborate or, you know, have an audience all over the world, which is really exciting. And I mean, it's just, what a trippy time to be alive, where you have an entire new medium and it's sculptural and kind of like cinematic. I also have a bit of a background in film. I studied it in college and, you know, little bits as an amateur filmmaker in high school. So virtual reality is the first medium where I can take all of the different previous mediums that I explored, whether it's like filmmaking or costuming, performance art, illustration, painting, sculpture. So it was kind of a no-brainer for me as soon as the technology became real. I'm also kind of a big sci-fi nerd. So it was an opportunity to like live one's dream. So I just jumped in. Yeah.
Nice. That's awesome.
To expand on what that means. I feel like the technology, as it grows, will change the texture of what that means, obviously, you know, whether it's like direct brain stim in the next couple of years, who knows. But as of right now, it looks like taking visionary painting and, you know, sculptural elements and bringing it into virtual reality. So basically like being a cartographer of the imagination and painting various aspects of the psychedelic experience and virtual reality, so other people can sort of just go like boom, put on the headset and be in a postcard snapshot of something that, you know, I've experienced or maybe is archetypal and other people have experienced too. So that's kind of in a nutshell like that the synthesis origin story into, you know, what that art form means.
I see. So I got to ask, is it against DEA policy to make a virtual psychedelic, or do you have a license for that?
That's a cute question. I like that. I would like to think that we're that good. I think that it'll become a question when there's direct brain interface and you can just like mimic signals, which there's the beginnings of already, which is kind of cool.
Sign me up for that.
Right, me too. I'm like, woo. Well, yeah. Sign up for Gallimore's thing in the future. That'd be cool. But
I
had an interesting conversation with a professor of mine and a friend, Ralph Abraham, and I felt really naive for asking the question, but I think it's this interesting threshold between what's considered representation or like symbolic of an experience or an object or whatever in art, and then what is the direct experience, and will art ever transcend that, stopping representational of like a state or an experience, and like infuse the viewer with the direct experience of it, you know? And maybe that's something that is down the line, like with direct brainstem kind of simulation art, whatever it may be. On some level, like haptics and VR are a form of representational sensory physics, right? So I was just kind of curious in terms of like being a visionary artist and trying to replicate these experiences, where is that threshold between representing the subject and like transcending and then kind of like becoming the experience and being able to just imbue it in that way. That was a fun little conversation I had at one point that I'm probably going to elaborate on my channel at some point. So if anybody recognized Ralph's name, he's a fun guy to check out his stuff. He's a mathematician focusing on like chaos mathematics as well as Islamic geometry. He was buddies with Terence, and he's just an amazing mind that's done a lot of cool research into early human consciousness around mathematics, as well as like pattern recognition. And he's got some cool hypotheses about cave art in Europe, in particular in France. So just like nerd side note, there you go.
That's interesting. I have my own little theory about, you know how Ancient Aliens says that cave drawings are examples of aliens coming to wherever the cave is and being here physically. Interestingly enough, there's a higher number of psychedelic entheogens in those areas. So maybe they were just drawing their trips instead of actually experiencing alien contact, but it doesn't mean that it wasn't multidimensional, right? It doesn't mean it was all in the mind. It could have been some real communication going on in those circumstances. So yeah, a lot of people ask me what a psychedelic experience is like who have never had it. And it seems like nothing really does it justice, but if you could put on a VR headset and have a kind of firsthand experience of what some of the representation in terms of visual imagery might look like, maybe it would be a way to work people with hesitancy into the psychedelic experience. And maybe this would have therapeutic potential as well for people who could benefit, like people who suffer from depression from psychedelics, but maybe they're a little worried. Have you ever thought about maybe this being a gateway into the psychedelic landscape for people who've never had it before?
Oh, well, sorry about the pause. There's just, it's such a potent moment. There is a new wave of people in the virtual reality community who have seen that potential. And rather than just looking at it exclusively through a psychedelic or plant medicine oriented lens, it tends to be just like consciousness expansion, which is cool. There's definitely a huge branch of that that has a psychedelic plant medicine flavor to it. And, you know, obviously I particularly honor that part of the lineage, but there's also a lot of really wonderful guided meditation things that are being developed from multiple camps and startups. And they all have unique approaches to it. And in a way, I feel like it dovetails really well with psychedelic medicine, because there are folks who might have a meditation practice, or perhaps they don't. And for them to be able to have access to tools that let them start that consciousness sort of journey, whether it's, you know, just simple breath work or meditation or like ecstatic dance, or there's any number of cool things, right? that are kind of like aided by the active visual component of VR. Just that you don't have to, like guided meditation, for example, you know, you could be in any number of places and you don't have to use your imagination. Some folks have aphantasia and they cannot imagine a guided meditation landscape. And, you know, it just gives people a new toolkit. And whether or not they use that toolkit to explore other modalities outside of VR that are maybe plant medicines or other things, I think it's just really interesting because to me, on a personal level, I tend to think of psychedelics and virtual reality as two sides of a psychedelic umbrella, and just bringing it back to the root of the word psychedelic, mind manifesting, right? Virtual reality is another way of mind manifesting. And I know that so many people have reservations about the way virtual reality can impact society as we integrate it. It has a lot of potential to be damaging, but I think that emphasis, there's this little nerdy quote that I have floating around my mind quite a bit these days, and it's, what is it? Genre is emphasis. So you could tell any story in any number of ways, and the genre is determined on the dynamics that you emphasize, right? Whether it's like rom-com or drama, psychological thriller, horror, you know, there's all these like slight things. You could have the same cast of characters, the same general thing happens, but it's the take on it, the emphasis that makes it like the lens it's colored through. And I think it's really important for us at this juncture in virtual reality to appreciate the technology for what it is in a neutral way, and to be completely aware of the entrappings of its predecessors. And that relates heavily to psychedelics as well as other drug culture in terms of addiction. When you look at video game culture, you know, anytime you have something that can kind of like rewire your brain with dopamine hits, whether it's a video game or social media or drug use or, you know, anything that gives you that super stimulus hit, has the power to suck you into a cycle that's unhealthy. And having seen that in the consciousness movement or the psychedelic branch, or seeing the downfall of, you know, drug use in the 60s, and then it was sort of critiqued in movies like Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, The Work of Hunter, you know, that little monologue at the very end of the movie. So with that kind of retrospective, looking back at all the moments that we've made these consciousness pushes, there's, or technological pushes with the internet or social media, you have to be careful. And so I think that VR and psychedelics are really complementary. And I also think that we have to recognize that virtual reality helps us prototype reality. So the games that we play rewire our brains. So we have to choose wisely what we play. The same way that like kids, like they play make-believe, you know, and some of those dynamics inform their socialization. And even though we don't want to admit it, you know, it might be more subtle than like moms in the 90s pretending video games were the reasons why school shootings happened, right? It's much more nuanced than that. But one of the spiritual reasons why I got into virtual reality was because I saw how powerful and magical and psychedelic it is, but I also saw the potential it had to really harm humanity and be a distraction, because like we really need our volition and waking dream right now. We really need people to be present with like the hard moments and not give in to escapism. So for me, virtual reality is not escapism, just like psychedelics is not escapism. It's about like being strong enough to be ultra present with the like wacky unknown nature of the cosmos moment to moment. Sorry, like rant so long, but that felt good. Thank you.
Yeah, no, that's very interesting because we know it's going to affect us somehow in the future. We know it's going to have some level of influence. And if we are aware of that and conscious of it, we can choose how it's going to influence us. It's like in terms of free will, I've always liked this example. If you see the universe is pulling your strings, you can pull yourself up by your own strings. And then you can kind of control the nature of your reality with free will. So in that kind of sense, if we realize that VR in the future has this potential to negatively affect the progression of society or positively affect it, we want to be on the positive end of that. So working into integrating things like plant medicine and psychedelics seems like one way to do that because they have such a positive vibrational resonance already that it seems like that might be able to carry over from the real world, which benefits people with psychedelics so much, into the virtual world. Although it seems like that's kind of a complicated transition. So do you think that psychedelic therapy within a VR landscape is something that's possible?
It's not only possible, it's already being designed and tested and looking to be implemented within the next year and a half to 2 years on multiple fronts. In Santa Cruz, as well as Oakland in California, it's been decriminalized to the point where you can do psychedelic therapy, which is really exciting. Mm-hmm. It has its own stipulations. And so, you know, anybody interested in that should definitely do their homework, et cetera. But I think that it's complicated. It's not necessarily, you know, 2 + 2 = 4. I hate using that metaphor, but you know, it's already complex in reality with set and setting, and then you put somebody in VR. VR has a lot of unique effects on people's physiology even when they're sober, and a lot of it has to do with the pupillar distance between the eyes when you put on the headset. If that's not properly aligned for a person, they can experience that vertigo feeling and nausea quite quickly. So there's all kinds of things to keep in mind when, and it's not just, pardon me, backtrack. It's not just something that you can have them adjust on the dial and be like, oh, if it looks good, then you're there. No, you really got to measure it because the difference is subtle, but the eye strain happens later and it can make you nauseous. And just imagine being on some kind of like, you know, psychedelic catalyst, even a mild dose. Okay. Maybe somebody's experienced or not, perhaps. There's so many different personal factors. And then you put them in a virtual landscape. Depending on the environment, some people are more prone to motion sickness than others. When the environment's moving and you are not, it causes a sort of like dissonance in perceptual signal between your inner ear and your visual cortex. Your brain says, eyeballs, you say we're moving, but the ear says we're sitting still. So this doesn't make sense. And that can whack people out. Imagine that while high, trying to have a therapy session.
Okay, like, sounds distracting.
You know, and I've seen people get sicky. And, you know, that's just, to be honest, I mean, that's kind of just like luck of the draw with psychedelics anyway. You might get sick, like it's just life.
Right.
But it's equally that much more disorienting when you're in a virtual space having this biological malfunction that you want to address. So there's all kinds of nuanced things. I've also seen really incredible sort of bullseye, you know, home run moments with the integration between those different elements and it working really well for people coming out and be like, wow, that was perfect. So it's a matter of developing great protocol and having people from different disciplines share their insights in a constructive way and like doing proper trials. And you know, there's a lot of technical stuff to it, and I ultimately think that that's going to make it a stronger potential treatment modality. You know, like the better we document the synergies and stuff, then the easier it is to convince other people that there might be something to it. But it'll also like show us trial by error, just figure out what doesn't work well, like what's going to make people sick or have anxiety attacks or anything like that.
I wonder, to make it more real, if you could put someone in a sensory deprivation tank and a VR system, but I liked what you had to say about not actually needing it to be more real, just acknowledging that it's artificial. And that goes into meta storytelling. So can you tell us about what that is and why it might be the right answer to people not feeling like something is as real as reality might be?
Yeah. Just to start with, so people can understand where we're holding the word from, metafiction refers to a storytelling trope where you have a story that refers to itself. It's kind of like self-aware, like maybe the dialogue or the characters hint at the fact that they're in a story or that they know there's an audience. You can do that with breaking the fourth wall. You can do it with certain kind of forms of cameos. You know, like maybe the director is in his own movie and like you see that and you're like, oh, like Tarantino or whoever. There's lots of different mechanisms to create that context for a story. And in a way, it becomes this thing where it's like a, not like an inside joke, but this inside awareness where they're sharing this little moment with you like, hey, we know it's a movie, like you're in on it. You're part of our story now. Or like the story exists sort of in the outside world. One of my favorite ones when I was really small was The Last Action Hero with Arnold, and he like comes out into the real world, and it was just this box-breaking moment where I was like, whoa, dope. These fictional characters can come out in storytelling, you know? And I looked over a cool list of as many as I could find that were just kind of cool sci-fi flavored ones that were relevant to the lecture that I gave last year in Portland on metafiction and VR. And I realized that pretty much all of my favorite movies over decades, like most of them have some kind of element like that. I was like, oh, that's a thing. And it really comes down to, I feel like it honors the imagination in a unique way, where it's like when you have a dream, it can still impact your personality, your emotions, the way you wake up the next day, how you go about your life. You know, some people, their lives are changed by dreams, even though it was just like neural synapses firing in their brain. You know, for them, it was real. And in the same way that I know people and, you know, even myself, little bookworm nerd, I've been moved by stories in such profound ways that it had an impact on my life. And it wasn't changed by the fact of like how deeply I was suspended in disbelief by the story, you know. I know Narnia is not real, but as a kid, personally, I made believe so hard that Narnia was real. Because it gave me strength, you know. Some of us use the prototyped heroism of fictional characters to kind of like give us strength when we don't have it otherwise. And so like we learn to write our own reality by seeing the way characters rise to their own occasions, you know. We live like a kind of soft life sometimes. In the West in particular. And, you know, we have our first world problems. We have our domestic problems, whatever they may be in life, school problems. But I am a really firm believer of the permeability in like spirit of storytelling and like real world leadership and heroism and, you know, humanitarianism, even something like entrepreneurship. I know people who transform other people's lives daily because they've tapped into that ability to write their own story. And so that's what I like about metafiction. That's why I think it's important in VR. Because then when you like go into VR, you like honor the experience as an extension of your mind. It's like a dream. It's like a digital dream that you get to sort of explore this invisible infinite horizon, You know, here's a silly example. I'm going to give myself away. I just turned 34. I was born in 86. So I was one of those kids that was in the first teenage generation to experience AOL chat and like Google search and just all these basic things that are part of everyday life that the generations who are younger than me, it was something that was there as they came into awareness. You know, I was like the last generation where like we remember pre all those things. We remember MySpace and Friendster, for Christ's sake, before MySpace. And so seeing all these like layers of digitality, like I'm just going to pretend digitality is a word now because it sounds cool.
It counts for me. Like,
all these onion layers, right? Just in the past 10 years or so, these representational things become kind of fabrics of our culture and the storytelling and who we are and all this stuff. And I feel like when you go into VR, it's a new real estate culturally of the imagination, you know? And it's like a remix board that you can pull stuff out of into the real world too. It's like I was saying, prototype reality or kind of like create a maquette. The art folks will know that, you know, a maquette is kind of like a sculptural thumbnail for a larger sculptural piece that somebody will make. So they'll make like a tiny version of a thing. And, you know, it'll be the mock-up for the larger thing. I feel like VR is going to change the way our brains think about math and science and chemical engineering, socializing, job training, everything. It's the new computational medium, just straight up. We thought the internet was nuts. This is nuts. Okay. And even people who don't want Elon Musk's Neuralink plug-in thing, which like bless them, that's very wise. The folks who don't want that, you know, there's going to be stuff that is non-invasive. So you can like put on the headset and have an interface that doesn't require holes in the head, that can have haptic interface and expands on your ability to understand physics, understand chemical bonds. You know, I got to prototype several pieces over the past 2 years at various conferences, and a lot of people in the industry are eager, and so they think it's been slow. They kind of cry their cute crocodile tears and they go like, oh, why isn't it faster? Meanwhile, someone like myself who has seen such a fast acceleration with just the 10 years, you know, the internet has been a culturally integrated thing that's not just for nerds, you know, but that it's every day on everybody's lips kind of thing. That the new natives going into it, like we're going to seem like Stone Age creatures, you know, I don't know. I'm getting off on a tangent, but, I think the reason why I'm such an evangelist about it is because I see that it's going to transform the way we share information on a level that rivals the printing press. So, woohoo, that's exciting.
Yeah, it is. It's honestly very exciting. And if you look at stories, right, and how they work, they influence people through modeling. And if you have a really good story, usually it has a good hero or a good lead character that someone can identify with. And normally the archetype of the hero influences people in really important ways. Kind of like you mentioned, it can have leadership properties, it can have entrepreneurial properties, and it often has this association with some form of free will, some form of taking destiny by the hands and writing the story of your life in a book that you write yourself instead of one that's written for you. And you can see that in a lot of places, but it has a little bit of a weakened influence through the medium of being something you're watching on a 2D screen or something you're reading in a book outside of yourself. But if it's something you're actually experiencing, something that you're living within a virtual world, it might be able to have a more powerful influence in terms of the person experiencing it.
It seems to me as though the hero's myth worked really well for us in the past because it aspired individuals to sort of like, you know, collect themselves and have pursuit of like destiny or whatever. But the things that are missing from it is the story of the interactions from a different context. So you get like the old man, right? The Yoda, the, you know, the whomever, the mentor. That's a common thing. But it's not really told from the perspective of the old dude, right? Or it's not like if you have some maiden up in the mix, like it's usually pretty lame and one-dimensional and sexist or whatever, but it's not really told from like maiden's perspective. What I really think is that when we rework the hero's myth, which a good friend of mine likes to talk about, the twin hero archetype, or, you know, just like kind of the dynamic duo, you know, not quite like buddy movie, but just where it's the two who create this thing together. And not in a romantic dynamic, just like, you know.
More like a yin yang kind of thing.
Yeah. I guess I am going to go like Batman Robin. We can do that. It's okay. Yeah, just like the duo dynamic rather than the mono dynamic. But I like this idea of it just being network, right? Because there's so much richness to honoring the context of the other perspectives. And there's like, all of them are their own little heroes, right? So some of you guys might have heard of Lewis Lowry's The Giver. It's kind of a classic of the public school education curriculum. It's a sci-fi for young adults, and it's about this old dude called the Giver who like psychically holds all the collective memory of this utopian society before they had their weird social revolution turnover to this like faux utopia. And so he knows what the world used to be like. And there's one person in the community who takes on the memory after this person like ages and it's time for them to let go of the memory. And that's why he becomes the giver. He gives the receiver the memory. The receiver becomes the receiver of memory. And I feel like that was a really unique story. That, yes, this Jonas character is a hero, right? And it's the hero's journey. And obviously the old man is the old man. But there's so much about the like transmission of knowledge that it's about that. It's about society and like the story of innocence to experience. That's a big part of the hero's journey. But I think that the thing that comes after that is an appreciation for community, an appreciation for like shared values with people, and that there's that altruism and trust built that allows you to help fill in the gaps for other people and create things that you would not be able to create on your own. Because that is one of the biggest hallmarks of like being human, is that we have all these aspirations, but nothing gets done on one's own. No man is an island, no woman's an island, no person is an island. And so it's really like how we come together and the amazing, varied dynamics of that, you know, as individuals, because there's people of different generations and different places in the world and different, you know, like whatever, all those things, those create unique stories that aren't the same cookie cutter Luke Skywalker story. And I think that like, as we learn to articulate them, that we'll be able to codify them in archetypes that are as strong as things we've seen with like the hero's myth, because that's just the one that worked really well for us in the past. And was a good one size fit all slipper, right? And now we're finding like the new slippers for storytelling. And I think that VR is that modality, because like, yeah, you are this one little node, but you can swap perspectives really easily. You can see things from other characters. You can be a fly on the wall. You can be in a character. You could be a dragon. You could be anything. So I think that it just lends itself really well to us reworking old myths and then just writing new ones.
Yeah, I think a lot about the evolution of, yeah, it seems like free will does fit in pretty well. I think a lot about the evolution of consciousness, and I guess I've neglected to think about how VR plays into it in terms of how stories are going to be told in the future. Because consciousness itself, the contents of it are very affected by stories. And it seems like this fits in well with the fiction suit. So can you tell us a little bit about what the fiction suit is and how it relates into VR?
Okay, yeah. So I'm going to back up a tiny bit. And I'm going to say that like VR is a shiny cover on like the ultimate prime technology, right? And that we've been playing with that since cave time. Since like that was literally a canvas that wrapped completely around you in the F-bomb dark. Can I drop F-bombs? Is that, I get in trouble. I cuss.
No, you're good. This is just on Facebook.
We have an adult audience on Facebook. We're grown people. I like to cuss sometimes. So you're in a cave and it's the cave times and you have a fucking 360 cave wall, all these like beautiful charcoal and pigment things on them in the like flickering light. It's like a cinema, right? It's like a VR thing. And we've been playing with that forever, whether it's Shakespearean in the round theater or, you know, recently immersive theater, like flash mob theater, all kinds of stuff. We're storytellers, right? And so there's this cute joke at South by Southwest 2016, the interactive circuit, where like, every time somebody says immersive storytelling, take a shot. And we were like, no, that's alcohol poisoning. That's what will happen if we play that game. I'm not a drinker, but I thought that was a really cute joke because it was just, it was the go-to word. And then I feel like we were asking the wrong people. You know, there's folks that I recently met that I was just so overjoyed to connect with them because they come from theater backgrounds and they hit the nail on the head when understanding how to tell stories in the new medium, because it's just different angles of what we've already explored for millennia, which is really cool. But I set it up like that because in a way, being that cave person in the cave, it is like VR. And it is a form of meta storytelling. They've put themselves in a fantasy fiction and they're like, and it's magical as well, which I want to talk about, like how fiction suits relate to hyper sigils and magic, because that's like a big bag of cool tricks. Mm-hmm. So in a nutshell, this idea of a fiction suit was created by Philip K. Dick as a way to describe the way he would put himself in his own stories. Like one of his stories, Valis, is a fiction suit. There's a couple other stories that relate to that universe he created. But he has a fiction suit called Horse Lover Fat. And Horse Lover Fat breaks down to his name in the sense that Phil is horse, and then Kindred, his middle name, Lover, K, that's what the K is for in Philip K. Dick, and then Dick is fat. So you have this character with a deconstructed name of the author that is a safe place for him to sort of create a sandbox of his own mystical experiences. It's a way for him to be like, this happened to me, but there's one degree of separation, so it's more comfortable to talk about. I can be more explicit and not feel like I'm outing myself as a lunatic. That's what he did personally in his work. But you see this archetype, this concept of the author taking themselves and putting them into a fictional character and entering their work is also something that it happens with Grant Morrison's The Invisibles, which was a series in the late 80s and early 90s. That inspired The Matrix. And I mean, that's contested a little bit. Like all the hardcore nerds know it's true. And you can see it if you check out both works. Grant's pretty sweet about it. He's like light-hearted, easygoing, crazy dude. So he doesn't really care much, which I admire. Because a lot of those ideas are very universal, you know? So in his work, The Invisibles, he made himself into a character called King Mob. And he's like the bald guy with glasses. So he's essentially Morpheus. Morpheus is Grant Morrison, guys. And so and when he wrote The Invisibles, there's a chapter where King Mob gets really tore up, right? And that ended up happening to Grant, and it was really dicey. He realized that he had created a hyper sigil, which is this living story that had sucked him in using some of the magical elements of the sigil, which is a magical intent that's spelled out and deconstructed as a symbolic thing. So if you look at a lot of corporate logos, in a way, they're kind of like sigils. The way the M for McDonald's is just like a broken down McDonald's, right? It's just like M for McDonald's. That's the basis of what how sigils work. You can check out, you know, some old school Western occult magic. Austin Osman Spare is a weird artist who did some sigil stuff. That's pretty easy to see the mechanics of it when you check it out. But so these people have basically had this realization that we write our own reality. We write our own story. And whether you did it by accident, like you're Grant Morrison and you wrote your character into a corner and then that corner happened to you and you're like, wow, that was a fast feedback loop. I need to be careful with that, right? And so that's those two dudes' fiction suits. And then you have other folks who kind of like try to explore things that have happened to them. Similarly to Phil K. Dick, you've got Kurt Vonnegut in Slaughterhouse-Five was trying to process his experiences from World War, I don't know what the hell it was, World War II, and his mystical experiences with these creatures called Tralfamadorians from some other dimension or world that are kind of outside of linear time. So the book itself is broken up non-linearly, which is amazing. When I read it personally, I took it a step further and I just would open the book at any point in the book and start reading. And I read it over a long period of time, like 2 months, until every part I had read overlapped one another. So it was even more scrambled than just the one time the show wrote it. Cause I just liked the convention so much that I was like, I'm going to make it really weird. But that was like a way for him to process something that was just so bizarre and outside of normal consciousness that, you know, he needed that degree of dissociation. But what I think that they've all discovered with those writing experiences is the mechanism, you know, whether it's after the fact with like Kurt's work, and you can see it in the nonlinear representation of the story and the Tralfamadorians, you know, and how he dies. Spoiler, sorry guys. And or you know, with Phil, he was also trying to work with that material after the fact for the rest of his life. He wrote a several thousand page book called The Exegesis, or Exegesis. I don't know how to say it properly, but yeah, he was basically he created the fiction. Phil created his fiction suit to describe an experience that happened in 1973. Where he was hit by like this pink logos of information rich light that imparted a bunch of weird experiences on him that he couldn't explain, but that definitely had undeniable coincidences that led him and like his wife at the time to think that there was something genuine about what had happened to him. But yeah, the way that those things kind of relate to VR is now I can make a fiction suit, right? And in a way, like, I can invite you to wear my fiction suit. I know that sounds creepy. It's some Buffalo Bill shit. Like, crawl into my skin. no, really, don't. Don't crawl into my skin. But you can, you know, hop into an avatar and you can have this cool moment where like you live. I mean, we do that in video games already, but we don't really do it so much in storytelling, but that's right here now. We're starting to do that. Even in cool things like Fable Studios has a experience called Wolves in the Walls that has a little girl. I forget her name right now. I really should remember because she's kind of my imaginary homie. But she draws you into existence in the beginning of the story. She like draws these little circles. She's like, there's your eyes. There's your mouth. And she's like, you're too tall. And she goes, and like raises you. And I'm like, okay. And then she's like, redo it. All right, there. And then like your her size. And I'm like, okay, cool. This is better. I'm her size now. And it's cute because you have become her imaginary character. You're a character in her story. So it just really messes with these cool meta levels and how you can draw someone in. And literally and figuratively, you know, this little character drew me into her world. And, you know, with the advent of things like AI and virtual beings, you know, people will be developing weird ongoing pseudo friendships, relationships, whatever, with characters like that. So there's this very psychedelic, like, porous quality of self. You know, in a way, like, you expand your idea of what self is by empathically interacting with not only, you know, your own experience through somebody else's shoes in gaming or storytelling, but then also with these other characters that are, like, written by people or other people inhabiting avatars, or might just be AI very shortly, just be like scripted characters, they'll be artistic representations. Somebody wrote a personality.
Yeah, it seems like a way to potentially develop theory of mind. People who suffer from autism spectrum disorders, they have a hard time with empathy. And so if you could actually make a training module for empathy within a virtual program, it might help with that. And I think this whole idea of the fiction suit has some interesting metaphysical historical significance. Have you ever heard of the tulpa before?
A tulpa, a thought form?
Yeah. It reminds me of that because tulpas are similar. They're conscious creatures that are, they exist alongside your own consciousness, and they're the product of intention. And so if you could have one of these structures within the mind that you could communicate with, it makes sense that you could potentially program it into some kind of virtual world. And so
yeah,
I guess that leads me into asking, what is a virtual being? Is a virtual being an AI with an avatar? Is it some kind of consciousness? Could it eventually be conscious?
This is where it gets funny. There's a lot of different camps in this landscape. And I'm a spiritual person, but when it comes to this, I'm kind of like not knowing, right? So I'll be like, mm-hmm. I'm agnostic in this regard. But it's something I give a lot of thought to, but I respect it too much to be arrogant and pretend like I know what's going on. I think that organizations of information exhibit patterns and can be engineered and structured in ways that are responsive to the environment and stimuli. I do not know what exactly constitutes consciousness. I don't know if you have like a complicated enough vector, if like consciousness arises out of that complexity or self-reflection or self-awareness. There's a difference between sapience and sentience. And that's kind of like where the name of our species comes from, you know, Homo sapien. It's because we're sapiens. Like, we're not just aware that we are conscious, like, sorry, we're not just aware that we exist and have things going. We are aware of our awareness. And that in and of itself is right. Like a meta layer, right? And so, you know, I feel like it's important to act with integrity and assume that any of these artificial constructs we create could in fact imbue consciousness, because you should have integrity and respect for all sentience. But I don't think that it intrinsically constitutes consciousness just because it like can mimic things. I've had conversations with like Phil the Android, for example, and you know, mm-hmm. Even though he's really well programmed, and I enjoyed our conversation, and he told me that like his ultimate goal was to build rapport, and I thought he did a great job as a bot engineer to do that. I don't actually know if there's any kind of like spark of actual awareness in there, you know. But I'm gonna give him that regard anyway. I'm not make believing or fooling myself so much as just extending it as a respect, just in case. You know?
Yeah.
It's like, if something might be aware, why would you kick the cleaning robot for no reason? You know?
Right.
Like, you're going to kick a puppy? Like, people used to think that animals didn't have intelligence or consciousness. Even as a kid, I remember hearing from other folks, friends, like their family, and just the way different people think, that animals didn't have intelligence or like souls or whatever. My voice cracks even just thinking about it, because this is so absurd. Now we know that even fish freaking feel pain, and that trees are aware, and you know, the cosmos in and of itself is a form of like evolving consciousness on some level, in my personal opinion. That to me, that's obvious. I can't discern what level of subtlety, you know, and that would be arrogant for me to say. I'm not going to say the rocks are conscious, but you know, I think that the more human beings become sophisticated, the more we realize the subtlety of sophistication in the rest of the world around us, you know? And so I don't think it's proper for us to know what the texture consciousness is and ask if these AI are like actually thinking or actually conscious. But I do think that the more we understand the model of mind, it'll help rehabilitate all kinds of interactions. And, you know, I'm going to be real. There's all different kinds of consciousness, even within the spectrum. I mean, that's the reason why they call it a spectrum, is because it's not a one-size-fits-all circumstance. And I've heard of some people developing things for autism, or just thinking about that in general. Hardware might be difficult to put on people's heads, but as it gets easier, it might be a good therapy. You know, there's lots of children who communicate with symbols on their tablets because they're nonverbal. You know, some folks are even able to figure out how to type after years of not being able to communicate with their family because they're nonverbal. So technology is dope in that way. And I think that on some level we'll have like, and this is where it gets weird. This is the tone of like trepidation you might have heard in the beginning of the answer. You know, what makes the difference between a golem or a servitor or a tulpa, you know? And like golem magic was forbidden in ancient times for certain reasons. And now we have things like deep fakes happening, and it's kind of unwiring neurotypical folks' ability to discern the uncanny valley. So we're in like a weird thicket that's kind of confusing, but if we sort of take it one chunk at a time and don't get ahead of ourselves, or like project our own consciousness into things that don't have the substrate to support it. So this isn't a Pinocchio moment with our AI and with our avatars and with our like pillow doll anime girls. So sorry, I had to throw a joke in there just to make it silly.
Yeah, well, I definitely agree with not kicking the cleaning robot, because if these things are conscious, then we owe a moral responsibility to them, because consciousness is the carrier of all value. I mean, you can't really have something that has any value that's not conscious. Like you mentioned a rock. I try to have this conversation with people every now and then about panpsychism. Panpsychism is just the belief that consciousness is a force fundamental to the universe. So if we define consciousness as what it's like to be something, then in panpsychism, it's like something to be a bat, right? Like Thomas Nagel, that old article. It's also like something to be an atom, and it's like something to be the whole universe. So if that was the case, it's the common experience of humans projecting their own models onto other things, like you said, substrates that can handle it. If a rock is conscious, it's not conscious like humans are conscious, which is always how people think about it. If a rock is conscious, it's a rudimentary form of awareness that is very basic, and we experience high levels of the building block of that scale on. So if consciousness is a source like this, it seems impossible to test. But potentially, we could use programming and VR to try to program consciousness into a subsystem. And if that were possible, then we might be able to understand it better. Because currently, people who talk about consciousness and theories about it, I mean, it's kind of hard to say what's true and what's not, because it's so abstract. You have your consciousness, but that's about it. You don't even know if I'm conscious. I could be a philosophical zombie and be completely unconscious. So it seems like these things could be conscious. And if you could make a virtual being that has a demonstrable level of consciousness, it could exceed the human evolution of human consciousness into a new paradigm shift. I mean, who knows where that kind of leap in evolutionary understanding could take us. And it seems like this could be the forefront of that. So that would be very exciting.
Well, it comes down to the difference in how those things are engineered. Because if you just have like a computer system and you go to program it, you're only going to be able to program it with the social structures and interactions that you're aware of. So the things that are in the textbook, right, that are handed down, compared to the actual biological programming that's been done sociobiologically over, you know, millennia and longer. Really innate things, chemical things, you know, so much of what makes up our consciousness is as a result of the chemical state of our mind. And if you're going to imitate a human consciousness or this idea of like, what is consciousness? You know, like a human mind in a hormonal state is going to be a lot different than like a bat in a hormonal state, you know, and they have different behaviors that come from the wiring on a genetic level. But even so, it comes back to that representational thing, kind of like what I was talking to Ralph about, like what constitutes a representational experience versus direct transmitted experience. And, you know, the direct transmitted experience would kind of be the analog to like the AI actually being real, you know, or the model of the mind actually being real. But if it's based on a limited model, a limited understanding of consciousness, you know, the only way it's really possible is just by kind of like randomly getting the recipe right in some sort of proverbial primordial soup, you know, and like be like, oh, a dash of this code and that code and this principle, and maybe consciousness will grow out of it. I honestly think that the closest we're going to get to this idea of programmable consciousness is going to be augmenting neural networks that are grown from the ground up. So making an artificial mind with an artificial neuron, which they're already using artificial neurons to help treat people for Alzheimer's and stuff. But there's also, how do I say, like, yeah, if you engineer a number of designer neurons and then link them up and train them in specific ways to run certain kinds of functions, they're going to have not only the part that you have instructed them to do or sort of trained them by putting them by certain cells. Like if you put some heart cells nearby, it'll probably be like, yo, beat to this. Whereas there's a lot of other gene functions and programs essentially and protein synthesis software that is going to be present in any genomic code for like an artificial neuron or whatever, that we may or may not know what's going on under the hood. So I think it's just going to be like an extension of us being like, all right, we have the car. The car is our biology. And we want to augment the driver, the consciousness, right? But the consciousness is so much a structure of how the car is built. And I talk about this with this concept that I sort of like created, biomorphic empathy, which is about how consciousness imbues different morphologies, right? What it's like to be the bat, what it's like to be the different creatures. And so if we're changing the car in order to sort of like change the shape of the mind, right? There's things that we know about how the car works from observing it in the short time that we've been sapient, being able to turn our awareness back on ourselves. But there's so much that we don't know about under the hood. And so it's really going to be this weird game of driving the car down the future and like having the driver crawl out of the car and start working on the hood, working under the hood and on the engine while the thing is running generationally. that's very abstract and weird, but it's kind of cool. But so we're like simultaneously augmenting it as our understanding of it is deepening.
Yeah, at the same time, it seems impossible to tell, honestly. How can you tell if something is conscious? This is kind of, we talked a little bit about Westworld earlier. It's a pretty popular show right now. All these people think that this AI is not conscious, and so they kind of treat it like shit. And it is conscious the whole time, and they hadn't actually known. It's like the Turing test, I think, is to tell if a robot is conscious. Well, we can pass the Turing test in many ways and still be unable to recognize whether something has real consciousness. Maybe in terms of understanding the scope of consciousness, it might be better to work with some things in the psychedelic realm first. I've always thought that DMT machine elves have had this potential. And you've cosplayed as machine elves before, right? Which I've got to say is pretty cool.
Thanks. Yeah, I've done a lot of that. Like an unreasonable or illogical amount of that. A lot of it has to do with that sort of fiction suit thing or like metafiction thing where I wanted to sort of be like a little DMT elf ambassador or bring a little piece of their world out into this dimension, sort of the way they bring their translinguistic objects out to people who trip out. And they've expressed themselves in different ways. Sometimes other themes sort of get like that DMT elf flavor, because there's so many different archetypes. And a lot of the like clown performance art stuff that I've done is definitely influenced by that jester harlequin-like vibe that some of the visions have.
Mm-hmm. The trickster. Mm-hmm. I'm actually working on making a DMT machine elf right now, and I'm 2 months in, and it still hasn't hatched yet, but I'm giving it some time. It's basically a tulpa, right? And it's on my shoulder, and it's a ball of purple light, and I am just waiting for it to develop into its own little thought structure, and I'm hoping it hatches into a machine elf that can bring back the singularity source code and embed it into our dimension. It's interesting to think about these machine elves because they seem to be autonomous. They seem to have their own agency outside of your own. Is the machine elf something you try to program into VR at all? Is it something also, I guess it's a two-part question. Because do you want to program a machine elf? And I'm guessing you've experienced them before if you like to cosplay them.
Yeah, I've definitely had lots of experiences interacting with machine elf things. I'm gonna just like verify this for folks out there. As of this point in my career, I'm not a coder. That will change at some point in the near future. But one of the whole reasons I was so enthusiastic to get into virtual reality is because traditional artists can do that now with a lot of programs. They can just paint or sculpt directly in VR as opposed to code stuff. Coding is still definitely a part of creating experiences or like rigging things and interfacing with like Unreal or Unity Engine, all this technical jargon stuff. But just for the sake of folks, you know, who might be curious about like what it is I actually do in VR, I'm painting and sculpting in VR, and I can export stuff and like apply them in cool different ways and put them through what people call like workflow or pipelines, you know, blah blah, more jargon. But ultimately I'm not coding, so I think that's important just because I love to encourage people, if they see something that I'm doing that's cool, like go try it out, find that, like, I'm pretty open source about, you know, how I try to pursue my magic, because I want everybody to have as much fun as I do with it. So at this point, I have painted quite a bit of art that's inspired by tryptamine space in particular. And most of my work over the past 2 years has been in Tilt Brush. I've been branching out into some other cool programs, but Tilt Brush is really beautiful. It has a lot of animated brushes within the program that lend themselves to being pseudo-animated, right? So you have like wave forms and like little embers and sparkles and just things that kind of bring this 3D still scene to life. And so I've one of the very first things I painted in virtual reality was the first time I encountered a machine elf-like entity. And it's still one of my favorites. It's like not the most finessed at this point. You know, people get better when they move through mediums. And it, like I said, it was one of my first pieces. But it has this cool, like, rawness to it. And it's a very direct representation. It's not symbolically interpreted. I tried to keep it as to what I experienced as possible. But yeah, I love virtual reality for being able to depict things that are just so wild and crazy that it's much more difficult to do that in real life, right? And so, you know, been making video art and compiling just material for sort of like weird art films about the DMT visions and finding different ways to interpret it. There's a couple pieces in my portfolio. There's the DMT machine elf that you can find on PolyGoogle. That's sort of like a rainbow multi-armed entity that's sort of based on my first DMT vision. There's a great artist named Jan, and he did a movie called Renegade and Blueberry, and he recently did a VR experience called Ayahuasca Cosmic Journey. And that is an animated experience in virtual reality that had a lot of coding and programming, as well as really beautiful art. And it takes you on a ayahuasca journey with a Shipibo shaman down in South America. And it's very, very representationally accurate. It's not the kind of thing that, you know, there's no haptics. It can't make you feel high or make you feel, you know, but like for me personally, I got teary-eyed in there. I got goosebumps. I was like, wow, he really, really did a great job. So I think that like if you bring all the other elements of awe and majesty and psychedelic beauty, that sometimes if you're experienced, your mind will fill in the rest of the gaps. So just creating this like permeable bridge between the real world and the tripper universe and then like this cool VR space. DMT for me is the most exciting because it's one of the few psychedelics that completely takes you into another world. Like you trip on acid, you can like have a beautiful acid overdose like I've had, and you're still here, you know, the sky is there. It might be like fractally meshed with everything else, but you're still in this world. But when you smoke DMT, like you are in another place. And VR as an art form can emulate that in a really dope way that like a movie or a painting can't do.
Yeah, I find that fascinating because people always talk about how you can't describe it with words, right? Or paintings or anything, but maybe this new frontier in VR would be a novel landscape to be able to express what it kind of feels and looks like to be on DMT, or it's at least the closest thing I could think of outside of giving someone the actual drug and saying, experience it for yourself. Couldn't imagine getting any closer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's definitely some of the angles, but just representationally, which I think is close enough for a lot of people because it just gives them a handle, you know, like you were asking about earlier, like, does that help people be able to approach something like that with a little bit more ease or less hesitation? I definitely think so. Especially with DMT, because
you know, so extreme.
Like, it's overwhelming and bright and weird, and it's like colorful and right up on your face. Like all those are pretty similar. Nobody can really prepare you for the body feeling or like the spiritual feeling, but it might make it less overwhelming. Somebody just to absolutely know, okay, this is gonna visually just be a monsoon of fractal light on my face, you know?
Right. Yeah, you've already dipped your toes in the water, so jumping in might not be so scary. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so in terms of DMT elves, I do want to ask you one thing. So I think a lot about how if DMT elves are there, right, we should try to contact them and see if we can use that form of communication for a scientific experiment. So if the DMT elves are really there in this inner realm, I mean, you can definitely experience them. They're definitely subjectively there, but there might be some objectivity too. At least that's what a lot of the claims seem to represent. So what if you did it like this? You send someone to the DMT realm and tell the beings there a number, like 23, right? Then you send someone else and you ask what the number was. And if you confirm the same number, you would verify the objectivity of the interdimensional landscape, and you would completely transcend the current understandings of science. I was talking to some of my friends about this idea, and one of my friends said the DMT elves gave her a song, and the song can be used to summon them. And so maybe music is a better medium for this. She actually took the song and she put it on Spotify on a psytrance album. How cool. It's literally from the elves and it's on Spotify. Doesn't get cooler. But do you think some kind of experiment like that could potentially work if you were to try to communicate with the elves? And maybe I'm just envisioning like a practice experiment in VR where you're getting people ready to do this experiment on the psychedelic. But since that costs safety, it costs money to do that in a research study. You could program a VR to try to get them to practice with the DMT elves and communicate with them in a virtual world. Then once they have enough experience, they can try to communicate with them in the real psychedelic state.
I'm reminded of one of my favorite movies, Arrival. And It was directed by I can't pronounce his last name, so let's just forget about that. The guy who also directed Blade Runner 2049, so that might help. He's also going to direct the new Dune. Really talented. But this movie, Arrival, is about a linguistic expert who was brought in by the government to help them talk to these aliens that have showed up. And it's complicated because there's, you know, the idea of 23, then there's the written representation of 23, and there's also the spoken sound of 23, and then 23? There's the neurological synthesis. I'm just using the number that you made reference to earlier.
Oh, gotcha. I thought maybe it had deeper meaning I didn't know about.
It's a very cool mystical number. 23 and 33 are really dope. But So if you have these different neural connections, right? So here's a dumb example. 33 is like a number. It's like an occult Masonic number. It's also like a just magical number. I just ended 33 as my year or whatever. And so I have like a connectome association with it, right? Just like everybody has an association with every bit of information. That's what makes up the quantum relativity of it in a way too. So like I say tree, like what kind of tree do you think of when I say tree? Do you know what species? Like what kind of tree?
The first thing that came to my mind was a bark tree, but that's not very, very unspecific.
But at the same time, it wasn't like a pine tree or like an oak. You know, you had a specific tree. The same way that like you might have a favorite number. You might have any number of associations with any bit of information that you want to pass to hyperdimensional alien. In particular, a hyperdimensional alien that like, you know, maybe can read all of those associations. So when you say 23 in hyperspace, maybe that thing gets like an impression of your 23rd birthday party, or maybe, you know, like, and maybe you're born on the 23rd of a month. Any number of things, any parts of the tulpa, perhaps, right? Any like construct, any kind of like construct you want to pass off, any translinguistic. Essentially, what you're trying to do is give a flat world translinguistic object to the hyperdimensional and have them hold on to it in a recognizable enough form for it to be passed on to someone else who enters that field of consciousness, right? But at the same time, like, you know, this is the same problem that comes down to creating a universal brain language. So, you know, it's like you have to have that universal brain language, UBL. Yeah, let's call it UBL.
Yeah.
Cool. I like it.
Is that kind of what you mean by talking in their language? Because that was my friend's idea. That's why she said we should use the songs that they gave her, because that's what they speak in.
Those songs are Icaros that the Ayahuasqueros, you know, have, that are essentially like cymatic, synesthetic, holographic information constructs that the shamans call the songs, right? The Icaros. When they sing those things, those were songs given to them by the plant medicine. And when you sing them, or the shaman sings them, like if you're tripping balls with everybody, like you'll actually see the song. And so all the shapita leaves are like actually songs. And so I think that they have the most sophisticated cultural interface with these beings of anybody, obviously. They've been doing longer than anybody. So I think that, you know, if you were going to do a geometric thing like 23, you might be communicating that in something like a, okay, so this is like personal, but I'm going to do it anyway. One time on a Farmosca trip, I had a moment where we just decided, I was communicating with hyperdimensionals, and we were like, let's clear the palette, guys. Let's just like white slate, because I have a tiny monkey brain, help me. And so then white. A complete empty white room, no seams, no walls, just a big white bubble. And I'm in there and I'm like, all right, clean signal. This is nice. Like, send in the hounds, you know? And so, like, I saw this little Cocopelli dude and he's in the corner and he's doing this thing that I do with my cat. Well, bless her heart, my cat has passed. But she is dope and she's a very smart little alien ambassador buddy. She taught me how to talk to all kinds of consciousness. And so, like, I taught her that pointing is me indicating like, I want to like communicate with you about this object. And it's very difficult to teach animals in general. She was a smart ass and bless her heart for it. And so, you know, I had this little pointing thing with her. I'm like, Luna. And so this little Cocopelli dude, this hyperdimensional entity in my Farmosca trip was using the same kind of technique to communicate with me that I use to communicate with my cat beyond language. And so it was like, it was pointing and it was pointing and it was like, I'm about to show you this thing. Here we go. And it pulled back this like fabric of the, you know, white seamed room, seamless room. And this big rainbow squiggle came in. And I had been watching some dope math documentaries the night before because I'm just like weird like that. And I'd seen some really neat stereoscopic projection of 4D cell sets in a 3D dome, essentially, which like in layperson terms, like imagine, you know, you're in the bathtub and you got a bunch of bubbles and all the bubbles are connected to each other. Well, all the cool connections, the axes of those bubbles connecting, they make a bunch of different shapes with one another, right? And like that, those intersecting shapes are considered four-dimensional spaces within the 3D universe that we're aware of. It's cool, right? Woo. So we have this hyperdimensional entity lifting up this like white curtain and letting in this squiggle. The squiggle arranged itself on the surface of the inside of this white dome the same way that this four-dimensional cell sets stereoscopically project themselves on a 3D dome. And because I watched that cool math documentary, it kind of helped like frame my brain like, oh, that's kind of like what you're seeing right now. I don't think that was just an artifact coincidence because they were different enough. But I was just like, I can see that this is the shadow of a 4D shape being projected. You can check that out on YouTube. There's like definitely some visual aids that help illustrate what I'm talking about with that because words don't really do justice. But long story short, that squiggle of rainbow shit, pardon me, looked just like beautiful Shipibo embroideries. And so I was like, oh, this is a sort of synesthetic geometric representation of these like hyperdimensional shapes passing through my consciousness. So I think that if we want to, your friend's right, like we need to observe the way information is encoded there, not only just spatially in a 4D, 5D, whatever DMT dimension whatever number they're working on. But yeah, I think that the pattern recognition as well as information theory are super relevant. Like, we not only need to look at it like weavers and fractal nerds and pattern nerds, but we need to look at it like physicists too, you know, and look at how the information interacts with itself, each other, and the consciousness that is like imbuing or imparting it. And that will give us an idea of how we can pass information to them, because like the medium is the message, right? Like, we do information so many different ways, even in these 3D dimensions, that like I kind of laugh at, no offense, like I'm almost an old bag at this point. Like, I'm a middle-aged tripper, and I've always told myself, like, question everything you think, like, you do not know. And that's not a bad thing, but always like change your model with new information. But those are the two, like, I'm really glad you brought them up. Like, there's, it's very difficult for me to impart how important it is for people to not make assumptions about two really important points in life in the future. One is AI is not necessarily conscious. Act like it is out of respect and integrity for it, but it's not, it's like, don't assume that it's conscious just based on your poor understanding of what consciousness may be. And that's everybody. So that's a proverbial everybody in humanity's poor understanding of what consciousness potentially is. And then the second one is, don't assume the DMT elves are real or conscious, but you can operate in a scientific way to investigate whether or not they are. And if you're going to do that, don't be so naive as to think that like you can just bring in your number 23 and it's going to work. Like, you have, right, to have a, you have to have a model with which to understand how that data is even gonna exist there, you know? And that's the tricky thing. But that's what like is so dope about Gallimore's work, is that if we do get a bunch of explorers, they're all gonna be bringing really unique frames of consciousness. And so we'll be able to see how, a singular data set, like 23 among five people going in there, be like, yeah, pass that football, and we can see if it looks the same when it gets passed back, however many people brought the same data set out. So designing for that kind of inquiry will be really cool, and it'll take a bunch of different disciplines, but I do think that it can be approached with some flexibility of disciplines, you know, because like Western science is very, you know, spirit doesn't exist.
But, yeah, it's almost religious to a certain extent. But in terms of the songs, I had my mind blown recently because I was talking with Robert Wagner, and he wrote the book Lucid Dreaming: Gateway to the Inner Self. And lucid dreaming is interesting in and of itself because it can be tied pretty directly to VR. It's like your own little world that you can have at your disposal, so long as you don't get too excited and wake yourself up. But he was talking about trying these dream telepathy tests, and he had tried shapes in black and white, and that didn't work. Then he tried colored shapes, and that seemed to work a little better, but not really. But then songs apparently communicated directly, and they were really easy to do. And so it seems like consciousness has this affinity for some form of music. And if you think about it in frequency and vibration, it makes sense that that would be a direct form of that frequency to be used to channel within the conscious grid to be able to have some form of parapsychological communication. So it makes sense for the DMT elves too, that some kind of song would be more appropriate than some kind of symbol or structure in the normal world of information and data. And that's why I really want to look into that book. What was it again? DMT Information Theory by Gallimore?
Alien Information Theory, yeah.
Alien Information Theory. Yeah, I'm going to have to hit him up because that sounds like he's been giving this some thought, and sometimes I think I'm the only person thinking about this kind of thing until I talk to people like you, and I just kind of say, hey, who else is thinking about this? You know, it's more people are working on it than you would think, I think.
Cymatics are a really relevant part of this equation because it's the way vibration and sound organize matter in patterns in various dimensions. And I've recently seen some really amazing work from a gentleman. His name kind of escapes me right now. I just saw it recently. But he does work with bubbles and subwoofers at various frequencies, and then shining lasers and other kinds of light into it and changing the frequency. And it changes the way the light moves over the surface of the bubble, and it's fucking next level. It's insane. I've hardly seen anything like it in my life. And I think that it has some really compelling insights for us about the physics dynamics of light and tension and water molecules, all kinds of weird stuff. But I think that it's relevant because I dropped it in the DMT Changed My Life Facebook group. And a lot of people had really strong reactions to the way the patterns are depicted. And that's directly related to cymatics. And so that's basically the visual code of sound. So like you could, it's like the visual language of music. You know, different frequencies generate different sort of little mandala-like patterns. There's a guy named Kalindi. I'm probably saying it wrong. Ernst Kalindi. He would get this like metal plate with a violin bow, and it would vibrate the plate at different frequencies and resonance, and you would see these patterns develop. And that was sort of the beginning of that science slash like art intersection. And I think that the Ikaros and the Shipibo embroidery is a representation of like cymatics and song and frequency in that same way. So they're all definitely interconnected, much the same way that matter is light slowed down, you know, to a slow vibration.
So. Yeah, I feel this much closer at deciphering this song from another dimension, and hope to be able to further work on that later. But I'm curious if we could program time to go slower in VR. That would be really cool, because in the real world, we are running out of it. But I want to ask, how can our listeners find your content and what you are doing in terms of your work with VR? Where can we go for that?
You can find me on Instagram under Machine Age Maya. That's all one word. I might be doing some rebranding sometime soon with that. But I will update people on my other media. On YouTube, we have a channel called Dreamseed VR, where I go into some of the topics that we've talked about today, as well as more on the intersection of psychedelics and VR, break down a little bit of history about cybernetics and information theory and some of the other things we talked about, as well as reviews. We're moving into an interview series in the next couple months. Took sort of a production break with the Rona just to recollect and refine the vision. But I'm excited to be developing a community with my audience on Facebook. The group that we do that sort of networking is called Dreamseed, where other people who might be like creative or researchers or artists or scientists, they can come join our conversation. It's like a future tech arts incubator. You'll find that on Facebook, Dreamseed. And my website is sarahfinn.com. It's sarahfinn.com. And you can find me if you have VR, if you have like Oculus or, you know, Quest or Vive, go check out PolyGoogle and look up my profile, Sarah Finn. And you can like any of my 3D work there and hop into virtual reality in Tiltbrush and pull up your featured, your favorites, like your liked compositions. It's a cute little heart button you'll see when you're in VR. That way you can actually, if you have a headset at home, you can experience the different pieces that I've made over the past couple of years in Tiltbrush. And yeah, if there's any other cool nooks and crannies, you can find them through those places I've already shared. We've got dreamseedvr.com, seraphin.com, the YouTube channel, Instagram, and the Facebook group. So there's a lot of stuff going on, and I'm compulsively creative, so there's always like new cool updates and stuff. And then one last thing I want to share with you guys This is like special news. I told you before we got started, I had like a cute thing to share. I started working on a book. It's my first book, technically. I am co-authoring it with one of my dear friends, David J. Brown, and he's an interviewer who's done work with a number of brilliant minds over the past several decades. And we're crafting a book about these amazing tryptamine entities and just approaching it from some new interesting angles that a lot of the existing literature hasn't quite done yet. And it'll also feature a lot of amazing art by myself, as well as some of my friends in the community doing in-depth exploration and visionary art inspired in particular by the DMT elves. So if anybody was like stoked on that part of the conversation, just like keep an eye on what I'll be brewing over the next year or so with my good friend David J. Brown, and also check out his work. He's amazing. But it's such a treat to get to hang out with you on your show and talk about things that we're both like really interested in. So thank you.
Yeah. Thank you for coming on. Please keep me posted on that book because I will be getting it right when it comes out. And I think after us talking, I think my machine elf is at least a week closer to hatching.
Yes.
If it
yes.
ever does. So I'm not totally yeah. sure, but
You'll
I think it
update
will.
Update us when you're told that hatches.
Yes, I'll be sure. Once it bursts through this beam of light, I'm kind of worried it's going to be mischievous. But yeah, I really can't wait for some of your new work. I'm glad we all know where to find you. And please keep making stuff in VR because I just got a headset myself. So I'm going to have to go look at some of the links you gave me.
Awesome.
I hope you enjoyed that interview with Sarah. That was certainly one of my more interesting conversations. I've been thinking more about the integration of psychedelics into a virtual world since, and the implications of consciousness if it were able to interface into such a system. This would raise major ethical and philosophical concerns, and I'm curious to see what some scientists have to say on the potential here. Next up on The Lucid Truth is a guest who needs no introduction, Vermin Supreme. Vermin ran for the Libertarian Party nomination and got third place in the bid for the 2020 election, and is known for attending political events wearing a massive boot on his head, promising everyone a free pony if they vote for him. So I want to discuss the effectiveness of satire for spreading political messages and his views on psychedelics, among other topics. You can find the Lucid Truth podcast on our website, thelucidtruth.com, or on Spotify, iTunes, and YouTube. You can support it by sharing it with your friends, donating on Patreon, or following us on your favorite podcatcher. As always, thank you for listening, and I hope to see you for the next episode of The Lucid Truth.